Support for programming on NET Radio comes from History Nebraska. Nebraska's archaeologists work side by side with private landowners to protect Nebraska's archaeological heritage. To learn more, history.nebraska.gov.
Good morning and welcome to Friday Live here on NET Radio, live from the Mill in Lincoln's Haymarket. I'm Genevieve Randall. Some great theater productions to learn about this morning in Lincoln and Grand Island. Also, if you were a fan of the Blues Brothers movie, especially the music, I have a conversation with one of the original band members a little bit later. If you'll be away from your radio later, you can also stream the show at netnebraska.org or by using the NET Nebraska mobile app. We start this morning with a production from Angels Theater Company taking place at the Sheldon Museum of Art. Joe, not just Mrs. Edward Hopper, was written by Lincoln playwright Norman Simon. It's an hour-long one-person play that invites the audience into the Hopper world. And with us today to talk about it, Pippa White, who plays the role of Josephine Hopper, and Judy Hart, the director and producer. Welcome.
Thanks.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Glad to have you both here this morning on this somewhat chilly morning in Lincoln, I must say.
Yes. Spring.
Spring. Yeah. Spring in Nebraska. Well, Judy, some listeners may be familiar with the Hopper painting in the cafe. That's probably one of the most familiar paintings. Could you give maybe a brief description of who the Hoppers are, both of them, and their story?
Well, Pippa's going to jump in with me because we've been spending a lot of time with the Hopper family over the last 4 years, actually. Well, I think we know Edward Hopper as that iconic American painter of things dark. What do they say? What does Joe say about
his light has brilliance but no warmth. Mm. And he painted lonely. He painted lonely people. And he painted the marginal, left out people a little too.
Yeah, and Josephine and he were married in their early 40s, so it was 1923. So imagine that world of 1923 when these two painters, these two giant figures sort of slam up against each other in Greenwich Village in New York City with at Robert Henri's studio. So, and they knew each other and they painted together out on the Cape. So, and Josephine was was a wonderful painter, right? Wonderful is probably the thing that we have to question because we don't know her work. Uh-huh. We only see one piece of her work in our show. And when Edward died, Josephine actually donated all of his unsold paintings to the Whitney, along with her works, but her works have been displaced. So
it's a sad story in that before she married him, she was rising. She was getting attention. She was getting exhibits. She was getting good reviews. Hmm. And then something happened when she became a wife. Yes. His career took off and hers did not. So it's
to some women throughout history.
It's probably happened to many women throughout history. We're just shining our little lens at this one person because of we at Sheldon, they own one of the Hoppers, right? And it's literally outside of the auditorium.
Yes, it's exciting.
Yeah, and I've been thinking as we've been going in to rehearse, you walk past it on your way in and you say, oh, that's a wonderful painting. I've enjoyed it for many years. And then when the doors open and you exit the theater and you look at it, you say, oh, I know something more about that woman in the pink dress. Uh-huh. I've just heard her story. And that's such an interesting process.
And the painter who painted that woman in the red dress.
But let's talk about the playwright, though, too, because Norm Simon is a docent at Sheldon, right? So he has been interacting with that painting, talking about that painting to visitors at the museum for years, all of the time that he's been a docent. And he said he was always drawn to Edward Hopper's work, right? But then he read a book by Gail Levin, that is an intimate biography of Edward Hopper, and she talks a lot about Josephine Nivison.
Interestingly enough, she did two editions because she found the diaries of Josephine Nivison Hopper after she had begun the first edition, and so she went back and and brought a lot of Joe into that biography.
Yeah, and
so,
Norm decided
to put Josephine Nevison at the center in the spotlight in the production.
Yes, but we've been working on this for 4 years, so the story he's been telling has changed slightly to have a more female point of view.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, because that's that exquisite thing of living playwrights working with performers, is that you share what we think we hear about the story.
Yeah.
And we didn't think we were hearing more of Joe's story, and Norm listened to what we had to say and actually adapted, so because he knew women were doing his play. So it'll be interesting. He's seeing it tonight for the first time. He saw it once in rehearsal weeks ago. So it'll be interesting to sit in the museum, which is, you know, a remarkable place to see a play. It's not really constructed to be a theater, but...
it's going to work.
Yeah, it will work, and we're able to project images while we have the action on stage, which is, I think it's just a beautiful story about this couple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so Pippa, for Josephine Hopper, I'm sure you've learned many fascinating things about her. Are there aspects of her in her life that you find yourself able to relate to, or what did you learn about her that you found most interesting?
What did I learn about her that I found most interesting? She's full of energy. She's full of spunk, and yet at the same time, I think it was partly a difficult marriage. I mean, it was a difficult marriage, but partly because she has all this energy and all this life and all this vivaciousness, and he was the total opposite. So opposites do attract. We know that.
Right.
But sometimes it's so opposite that it's hard. It can happen.
This is a one-woman show.
Yes.
How did you prepare for it?
Well, it was a little different. You know, I do some storytelling performances, but then I usually have a lot of different characters, or at least a lot of different stories under one umbrella. And, of course, this is a true one-person show from beginning to end. So it was a different kind of challenge. I'm certainly glad I had a director.
And then when your actor comes in fully memorized, it's like, okay, here we go.
Ready to roll.
Seatbelts all.
So.
Yeah, it's a great team. You know, we were together. Pip and I met each other in the early 90s when we were teaching artists with the Arts Are Basic program. And it is actually how this Angels Theater Company began. We were sitting here in the Mill Coffee Shop, literally, in probably right where we are right now. We had invited all 18 teaching artists to come.
That's right.
To come and have a conversation about how to continue working together.
Oh.
And the only people that showed up were the theater people. So Pippa, I, and Sherry Cole Weber, we started talking here, and then we moved out to the Greek Orthodox Church on 66th Street, where we were surrounded by angels. And we started talking about, isn't it interesting how all the transitions in our life usually have a spiritual component, like an angel. And that was the beginning of the Angels Theater Company. And here we are 25 plus years later, finally working together again. It's only happened maybe twice along the way.
There were a number of shows we did in the 90s together under angels. But
we were
in the same place. We had followed husbands here. We had young children.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot to share.
Well, and I can feel with the two of you, I'm sure listeners can hear it, that there's this connection between the two of you. And I'm sure that adds a whole other layer to working on
We're not the only, but we're of a number of equity actors here in Lincoln, Nebraska. We are of the tribe.
Yeah, that's right. So, it helps us to bond.
And I also like hearing that Hopper painting is right outside.
Oh, it's
interesting
beautiful.
To think about as you're in, you know, right next door to it doing this production.
And even when we did the readings, people would say after the readings, I will never look at a Hopper painting the same way. So they will come out, Judy, and the painting they saw as they came in will look different.
It will.
Come out.
Well, so now I wonder what might be the future of this show outside of the current production.
Oh, we have big, big, big plans. So our goal is to tour it to every museum in the United States that has a Hopper. So we're going to start in Des Moines. They have Nighthawks. No, they have Automat.
Right.
They have Automat there. So, yeah, we have to make it a success here and then take it on the road. But it probably would be on the road not until
the fall
of 2020. Yeah.
I want you guys to send me selfies with the Hopper paintings as you go.
It looks like we're going to be at the United Solo Theater Festival, though, New York.
Oh, great.
This fall,
so
I don't know when.
Well, yeah. All of my best wishes for that. That sounds exciting.
You.
Yeah. Well,
let's talk about the dates for this weekend.
Yes, I've got that right here. So I want to note, too, their post-show conversations, yes, for the matinee shows.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the show is Joe, Not Just Mrs. Edward Hopper, and that will be performed at the Sheldon Museum of Art Auditorium all weekend. There are shows tonight at 7 p.m., Saturday.
7 is the important time.
Yes.
Okay.
That's
an unusual theater time.
Right.
So 7 p.m.
Saturday at 2 and 7.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are Sunday matinees, right?
That's
Sunday,
right.
Okay.
2 o'clock.
Well, I think we got it all.
Yeah,
you
tickets
did.
Are available at the door or online.
Sounds good. And we'll have a link to Angels Theater on
thanks,
the Friday
Cindy.
Live page as well.
Yeah.
Judy and
wonderful.
Pippa, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Hey, thanks.
Thank
yeah.
Thank you.
And again, you can visit netnebraska.org/radio to link to more on the Angels Theater website. Stay with Friday Live. We'll meet a co-director from a Grand Island production and learn about a concert featuring singer-songwriter Dan Weber in Seward tonight. This is NET Radio.
We're so glad to see so many of you lovely people here tonight, and we would especially like to welcome all the representatives of Illinois' law enforcement community who have chosen to join us here in the Palace Hotel Ballroom at this time. We do sincerely hope you all enjoy the show, and please remember, people, that no matter who you are and what you do to live, thrive, and survive, there are still some things that make us all the same. You, me, them, everybody needs somebody. Everybody needs somebody to love. Someone to love.
Someone to love.
Sweetheart to miss.
Sweetheart to miss.
Sugar to kiss.
Sugar to kiss.
The Hastings Jazz Festival next Monday and Tuesday features guest clinicians Kirk Garrison, Joey Galizia, Tony Galizia, Carrie Crist, and two members of the original Blues Brothers band made famous by John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. Tom Bones Malone and Blue Lou Marini will be working with middle school and high school bands. Joining me now to talk about the festival and other things is Tom Bones Malone. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Well, thanks so much. Tell us, what was the origin of the Blues Brothers Band?
Well, how much time do you have? I was at the first meeting at Saturday Night Live. I was the arranger for the Saturday Night Live show, and I was asked to go to a meeting in John and Danny's office where they had this first idea about the Blues Brothers. So I wrote them an arrangement of a song called Rocket 88, and we did it for Lauren Michaels. Didn't make the show. Following week, I worked up another arrangement of a song called Hey Bartender, and we did it for Lauren Michaels. Once again, didn't make the show. Danny and John decided to move on to something else. And the third week in a row, Lauren comes out of read-through and he says, the show is 3 minutes short. What are we going to do? John and Danny jumped on him and they said, Lauren, the Blues Brothers. So Lauren said, well, we have nothing worthwhile to put in those 3 minutes. You guys might as well make fools of yourselves. He put the Blues Brothers on the show. Well, we got all kinds of letters and cards and phone calls at the switchboard, and apparently somebody thought it was entertaining or funny or something, so we did it again. We formed a band separate from the Saturday Night Live band. We did a recording. We did a couple of movies, but it almost didn't get off the ground.
That's amazing. Have you heard from Lauren Michaels about that fact since then?
I haven't talked to Lauren very much about that. I was at the 40th. Anniversary of Saturday Night Live, and it was quite a nice thing. And that being said, I didn't mean to slander Lorne Michaels. He's a very nice man, always been going out of his way to be nice to me. I think his judgment overall, as far as comedy is concerned, is sort of unparalleled.
Were you surprised that then this led to films, albums, and tours?
Well, I was sort of playing songs that I used to play in high school in rhythm and blues bands in South Mississippi. I was a farm boy in the middle of nowhere, and I started listening to R&B music and started playing professionally when I was 14 in some really sleazy places. And I even gave Dan Aykroyd the story about playing in a club where they had chicken wire over the bandstand.
That's amazing. It's one of the fun scenes in that movie, of course. So I'm wondering, are there other nicknames besides Bones for musicians who play trombone? And if so, what are they?
I play trombone, tuba, trumpet, saxophone, all three saxophones, flute, piccolo, alto flute, electric bass, bass trombone, piccolo trumpet. You know, I play about 14 instruments professionally.
My goodness. So as a clinician with all of that experience, what's your goal when working with these young bands?
I have a lot of experience. I've been playing professionally for 57 years. I've played on 4,400 live TV shows. I've written 2,700 arrangements for television. I just like to share my experience with kids that are just sort of starting out and interested in music, because after all these years, maybe there's something I could tell them that might inspire them. I love that look in a kid's eye when they grasp a new concept, that look in their eye, like their eyes get wider, and I love that, and that keeps me going. After Hastings, I go right to Anchorage, Alaska, to another jazz festival.
Bones, thanks so much for telling us about the Blues Brothers story and other things about your visit to Hastings.
You're going to love Kurt Garrison, too, the trumpet player. He and I have been playing with the Lieutenant Dan Band, Gary Sinise and the Lieutenant Dan Band, for about the last 2.5 years. And he is an outstanding professional trumpet player in Chicago. My good friend since 1967, Blue Lou Marini, will also be at the festival. I've never met a nicer man or a better musician. Anybody that shows up for these jazz festival performances on Monday or Tuesday, I think they're going to just be very much impressed with Lou Marini and Kurt Garrison.
All right, Tom, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Tom Bones Malone currently plays in the Lieutenant Dan Band, fronted by actor Gary Sinise, who played Lieutenant Dan in the film Forrest Gump. A free will donation will be accepted at the festival's concert on Monday night at 7:30 p.m. in the Lynn Farrell Arena on the Hastings College campus, with all proceeds going to the Gary Sinise Foundation. Tom Bones Malone will join other clinicians at the Hastings College Jazz Festival Monday and Tuesday and be an artist in residence at Hastings Public Schools next Tuesday and Wednesday. For more information on the Hastings College Jazz Festival, go to our website, netnebraska.org/radio, and look for the Friday Live page. I'm Genevieve Randall. You're listening to Friday Live here on NET Radio. An extended family gathers in San Diego for a birthday party, but what should be an entirely happy event is shadowed by the knowledge that this will be the last birthday for the family's patriarch. All About Books host Pat Leach reviewed House of Broken Angels by Luis Alberto Urrea.
I recommend this to people who love family sagas, to perhaps that strange group of readers who join me in enjoying books that are a character's life reflections just prior to death, and certainly to people who appreciate strongly drawn characters.
You can hear the complete review of House of Broken Angels on our website, netnebraska.org/allaboutbooks. Next here on Friday Live, one of the co-directors of the next Grand Island Little Theater production joins me to talk about Moon Over Buffalo, a madcap comedy running April 5th through the 7th and 12th through the 14th. Jeremy Johnson, glad to have you on Friday Live this week.
Glad to be here.
This play is set, as people might guess from the title, in Buffalo, New York. It's also set in 1953. How are time and place important in the story?
They have a lot of references to at that time, current people that were in Hollywood, like Greer Garson, and there's quite a few others. You know, we didn't really want to change that. That's how it was written, so we stuck with that. And the clothing style would be, you know, 1950s for the most part, which is kind of fun to do. And the hairstyles would be 1950s, so it should be pretty cool.
I noticed that Frank Capra is instrumental in the story. He shows up. He was a very influential director, of course, throughout the 1930s and 40s. So in the plot, what does Frank Capra want to do?
Frank Capra is currently filming Twilight of the Scarlet Pimpernel, and his main actor fell down a flight of stairs.
Oh, no.
And so he's looking for somebody to replace him, and the leads in the show, George Hay and Charlotte Hay, used to be actors. They were, you know, they did a few Hollywood movies, and they were big on Broadway, and now they're just kind of touring the country, doing small theaters. And so he's coming there to recruit talent, basically.
You've mentioned that talent in George and Charlotte, and some other characters who show up are, for example, George and Charlotte's daughter's fiance, and then I also gather Charlotte's mother, which is where some of the comedy comes in. Do you want to talk a little bit about the comedic aspects of this show?
With Charlotte's mother, she is extremely hard of hearing, so there is quite a bit of yelling going on. A lot of miscues that happen because she can't hear very well. And then you also have like, their daughter comes back with her fiance. And a lot of things happen around that. I don't want to give away too much and give away the plot, but very interesting things happen around that. And then they also have their company manager, Paul, who used to date Roz a long time ago. So there's a little love triangle going on there that makes for a lot of comedy. And then there's also Eileen, who's a big part of the story as well. She's not in the play a ton, but she's a big catalyst in the play. Something happens between her and George. And then there's also a Richard who comes in, who's their lawyer, who's in love with Charlotte. A lot of little love triangles. It's just a really funny play. There's not a big, you know, moral of the story by any means. It's just a lot of fun.
How did this show get chosen for this season? Was there any reason in particular?
A friend of Todd's, Todd Burchard, who's the director over at Gish, Grand Island Senior High. He gave this play to Todd, my co-director, three or four years ago at least. Because he thought the play was hilarious. And so Todd read it, and he'd been wanting to do it. And we finally found a season that it just kind of fit into the theme. And I read the script, and I couldn't stop laughing almost the entire time. So we just convinced the production council to put it on. It's a little edgier than some of our other shows. There's just some language and some adult situations, but not too much by any means. We just really wanted to put it on, and they let us.
Anything else Grand Island Little Theater is doing that's unique for this particular show?
There's actually a really fun part that happens towards the beginning of the play. There's some sword fighting. We got a friend of ours, Matt Boyle. He does a lot of, he does everything. He does taekwondo, he does Krav Maga, he does all sorts of stuff. And we brought him in to kind of work with them on making the sword fighting look real enough, basically. And so that's kind of fun. The actors have really worked hard. Our two main actors, Ron Jelinek and Kit Collins, they're playing George and Charlotte Hay. And so we brought him in, and he's worked with them quite a bit on getting some sword fighting aspects. So it's kind of fun doing that. It's something we haven't really done a whole lot of. I'm looking forward to seeing that in front of an audience.
Sword fighting, comedy, love triangles, it's all in Moon Over Buffalo. Jeremy Johnson is a co-director for that production, a comedy staged by Grand Island Little Theater. Shows are at the College Park Auditorium April 5th through the 6th and 12th through the 13th at 7:30 p.m. And then there are 2 p.m. shows, both April 7th and 14th. Jeremy, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Serving your community anywhere that might be, NET Radio is Nebraska's public radio network, online, netnebraska.org.
South of Louisville, Kentucky, on I-65, I pulled into a rest stop before I pushed on through the night. I met a deadhead with a backpack, and man, I knew that guy. He asked, if you're heading south, well, I could really use the ride. But I'm only on the interstate as far as Bowling Green. Then I'm cutting west towards Memphis, where the blues don't drove the blue highways across Tennessee and back.
That is the song Hank and Jesus by Dan Weber. Musician Dan Weber went from being a national park ranger to a national touring artist after a performance at the Sisters Folk Festival. And one of his upcoming performances is in Seward tonight at Old Glory Theater. Hope Dunbar is here to tell us about the show along with Dan Weber, who drove straight here this morning from the middle of Iowa. So Dan, thank you for being here. Yeah,
pleasant.
And Hope, always nice to have you back on Friday Live.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
How did you, Hope, discover Dan Weber's music and then get him here to Nebraska to play?
Oh, well, I'm also a touring singer-songwriter, and what's great about being a touring musician is that you get to meet a lot of new people and hear a lot of great music along the way. And Dan and I met for the first time at the Kerrville New Folk competition at the Kerrville Music Festival down in Kerrville, Texas, when we were both finalists. I think that was back in 2015, maybe, Dan.
Possibly. That's a long time ago.
But we keep crossing paths a million different times. I mean, we run into each other at conferences and other gigs and stuff like that. So I've known Dan for a few years. I love his music, and I thought that he would be a great fit for our Seward Songwriter Series. So we're really glad to have him.
And Dan, you're based in Texas.
No.
No, you're not based in Texas. We were talking a lot about Texas.
Sorry. But
yeah, I live in Vancouver, Washington, which is basically Portland, Oregon.
Right. And how did you go? What was that transition like? How long were you writing songs or singing before you went from being a park ranger and then decided you were going to quit that job?
It's fun. I mean, I've always written, but I never really put two and two together. And then I got a guitar, but I was a guitar owner, not a guitar player for a lot of years. And there's a lot of us out there, and I started playing, and one day I hit 40 years old and decided I was going to go play an open mic as a bucket list thing. I had no idea this was in the future for me. It's really been quite a startling change in my life.
A startling change. Hopefully a good one, though.
Oh, absolutely. It's I love to tour, and I love to play for folks. And
yeah. So we just heard a little excerpt from Hank and Jesus.
Correct.
You want to tell us about that song? What's the story behind that?
Well, mostly it just happened because one night my roommate in college suggested we go see the Grateful Dead play in Louisville, Kentucky. And I happened to pick this guy up who sort of thought he was Jesus. And who knows, he might have been. But it was a fascinating car ride for a while. And so I could figure out ways of dropping him off somewhere.
Going through scenarios in your mind along the way. I can just imagine. Well, another song that we're going to hear after we're done chatting is I Deal With Crazy All Day.
And who doesn't?
So the meaning behind that, you know, is clear, I think, to everyone. But was there a particular event that inspired that song?
Oh, yeah. I had a bit of a dispute with my local cable provider. And I spent 59 minutes on the phone waiting for someone to answer the phone. And they said, Comcast, this is Philip. And then I talked to Philip, and then Philip said, I can't help you. And I might have cursed at him and hung up. And then I woke up the next day, and I still had the same problem. So I called back, and this time I spent like 30 minutes on the phone. And then they picked up the phone and said, Comcast, this is Philip. And it was the same guy. Which is like one in a million odds. And I asked him, I said, can I ask you a crazy question? He said, go for it, man. I deal with crazy all day. And I went, oh, I'll call you back tomorrow. I got to do something
right
now.
You're like, there's my song title right there.
It was like one of those. Yeah.
Well, and I was thinking that everyday experience can make a great song too, but it takes, you know, a spark like that to make you realize you can put this in a song.
Yeah.
And I hear that you tell stories also between songs.
But, I do,
you know, with that, it makes me think you still tell stories during your songs as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of goes both. It's funny. I sometimes it's just sort of random, and it's inspired, but I love that part. Because when you're conversational with an audience, the audience feels like they're sort of part of it. And there's the whole idea is when they hear a story or something that they can relate to, it's that connection that really is so powerful in performance.
So for any guitar players in our audience, what kind of guitar do you play?
I play a 1967 Gibson B-25.
Ooh. Guitar players are saying that. Yeah. Hope, you are a singer-songwriter yourself. What's your personal reaction to that?
That's cool. That's a cool guitar.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a small guitar.
In, yeah.
It's very old, but it's a small body.
So what else can we expect from tonight's show at Old Glory Theater, Hope?
I'll be opening the show as the opening entertainment.
Hope is so fantastic.
Oh, thanks, Dan. Come on down. I've been writing a lot of new songs, and so it's a great opportunity for me to share some new work. What we love about the Seward Songwriter Series is that, just like Dan said, we invite artists like Dan to come. It's an intimate gathering. It's a really great place for you to experience live music, where there's not just songs, but there's stories and there's connection and there's community. And so if you haven't been to one of our shows, we're glad to have you. You can buy your ticket tonight at the door. And Red Path Gallery and Tasting Room will be there to host a cash bar. And we're sponsored in part by Jones Bank of Seward, Nebraska. So we've got a lot of great community support, and we'd love to have you there.
And is it in an old church?
Yeah, it's an old church. Building.
Right. Great acoustics.
Very cool. It's an old church that's been renovated to be a theater. And just cool. Coming up, things to be excited for. We've got our annual melodrama that starts Memorial Day weekend, and it is not to be missed.
Yeah, all kinds of things happening at Old Glory Theater in Seward there. And then what's the future look like for the Seward Songwriter Series, Hope?
The future of Seward Songwriter Series is just chugging along. This is our fourth season, and I'm right now working on booking season number 5. We usually have about 5 or 6 shows a year, where we bring artists like Dan in from all over the United States, typically nationally touring artists, and have a great night of music. So we're really looking forward to the future. We're working on some collaboration with some other concert halls here in Lincoln and beyond, where we can start block booking, hopefully, in the future. So we're cooking up a lot of ideas to bring live music to Nebraska.
Right. Well, we look forward to hearing more all about it. And Dan Weber, thanks so much again for driving this morning.
Absolutely. Thanks,
I know you had an early morning today. And we've been talking here with both Dan Weber and Hope Dunbar about Dan's show tonight at Old Glory Theater in Seward. And again, show starts at 7. When do doors open?
6 p.m.
6 p.m. Doors open. Hope and Dan, thanks for telling us about the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
If your boss just caught you listening online and you wish you could catch up with Friday Live later, you can. We podcast the show each week, and you can look for that later this afternoon on our Facebook page or on our website. That address is netnebraska.org. You're listening to Friday Live, NET Radio's weekly showcase of arts and humanities in Nebraska. To check out the arts calendar on our website, both to make plans and to add your event. The address is netnebraska.org/radio. Just click events. Here's some highlights. In Wakefield, the Little Red Hen Theater presents The Odyssey in its final weekend of shows with an all-female cast. Sunday in Brownville, the Rastrelli Cello Quartet plays everything from Brahms to Beatles. And in Kearney on Sunday, First Lutheran Church presents Natalie and Friends, a concert including the UNK Flute Choir, Handbell and Vocal Choirs, a piano duet, trumpeter Dr. Timothy Farrell, and more at 2 p.m. For more information about these and other events, visit our website, netnebraska.org/radio.
Support for humanities-related programming on NET Radio comes from Humanities Nebraska, delivering opportunities to engage with history and culture on the web at humanitiesnebraska.org.
Lifelong Learning Institute and the Lincoln Community Playhouse pair up for another Radioactive Players show. The Radioactive Players provide theater opportunities for seniors ages 55 plus. This time, it's the Carol Burnett Show. The play opens April 4th with shows on the 5th and 6th. And joining me to tell us more, our facilitator, Lita Powell Drake, and director, Kim Osmond. It's great to have you both here this morning.
It's great to be had.
Thank you. Yeah, happy to
now,
be here.
Now, Lita, this is the 12th year for Radioactive Players. So how did these radioactive shows get started in the first place?
Well, it's really fascinating because I kept thinking there aren't many seniors who are up on stage anymore. And the reason is we can't remember a line. So what if, now I'm with Ollie, this would be the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. Mm-hmm. Now, what if we would do a show? I'm thinking aloud, you know, where we could actually hold our books and maybe we could do a radio show.
Yeah.
Like the Jack Benny show, which was available for free. You know, you could just download the script, and I thought, well, gosh, we could do that. That might work, and I wonder if anybody would come. And so I went to Maury Cohen.
Maury Enders, yeah.
There was a Maury Cohen I knew in the old days. Maury Enders at the Playhouse, and we talked about the possibility of doing it. So we weren't quite sure what we were going to do. So we used the Children's Theater, or now it's called the Studio Theater, which is a small area. We would do a play. We would do this particular show, the Jack Benny Show, because it was free. We like free. And we didn't know if anybody would come, but all of a sudden, you know, we promoted it, and we got actors out there, people who are age 50 and older, and they were, you know, they were playing, they were doing all of the sound effects and everything, and we were having so much fun. And we didn't know if anybody would come, but it was free. And all of a sudden, people started to come and come and come. And we had to put in more chairs and said, uh-oh, the fire department's going to close us down, you know, because we got too many people here. And we asked for a donation. They were very, very generous. And then we gave that to a charity. And I thought, why are we giving it to charity? We need the money. We should be giving it to ourselves. But we said, we're on to something. Mm-hmm. And the Jack Benny Show was so much fun. So then we started. And on a regular basis for Ollie, but you don't have to be an Ollie member to come and participate. Anybody age 50 and older can be in this. After the Jack Benny Show, we did War of the Worlds.
Oh, wow.
We did the USO Show, the Sock Hop, the Destiny of the Republic. Now, remember, that was the one book won Lincoln.
That was
just brilliant. And then we did the Roaring Twenties. We did Guys and Dolls, The Music Man, Fiddler on the Roof, Grease, Singing in the Rain, and then decided we had so many musicals. Maybe it's time now to go back to the old scripts, and we're doing The Carol Burnett Show.
Now, this production includes skits from The Carol Burnett Show.
Yes.
So maybe, Kim, you can also share a little bit about directing those skits or how it was decided on, what was included, what are some of the topics and skits we might see?
Well, you will not see the famous scripts like The Gone with the Wind or The Dentist. We didn't have those available, but we found found a whole set of Carol Burnett scripts, and I narrowed them down to six and just put together the ones that I thought were funny and would work well together. There's one with a couple in their bedroom late at night waiting for their daughter to come home from a date.
It's already funny, just the description, right?
There's one where a young woman is introducing her boyfriend to her father, and the boyfriend has some weird things going on. Several other interesting situations.
And people can use their scripts.
Yes, people can use their scripts, and that's a big help. It really increases the number of people who are interested in participating, and certainly helps our actors a lot. Now, a lot of them do become not necessarily memorized, but very, very familiar with their scripts, so they kind of have it there as a security blanket.
Yeah, right. It's just for security.
Right.
It's kind of my script, really, holding in my hand right now, a little bit of security. Yeah. Oh, it must be fun directing the shows. How did you get connected with directing?
This is my first directing gig. Yeah. I've been with Ollie for 6 years and got involved with Radioactive Players 3 or 4 years ago, and then worked. Maury Enders was directing at that time, the executive director of the Playhouse, and I acted as his stage manager for those first couple of shows. And then the Playhouse is just getting so much more active and so much more going on. He has to delegate more. And last fall, he asked me if I'd like to direct the show this year.
You know, can we hear about understudies for parts? But I feel like I've just heard the story of an understudy for director.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And I've been a performer all my life, dancing and singing, and then got into acting when I was in high school. So I've always been on the onstage side of things until I started working backstage at the Playhouse. Yeah. And it's a completely different world when you're not the actor. But I'm enjoying it, I'm going to say, almost as much as I enjoy being in front of the lights.
In front of the lights, in the spotlight itself. Right. Who are some of your favorite characters for each of you that show up on the Carol Burnett show or skits?
Oh, well, the people that I like most of all, Vicki Lawrence. Remember those little segments that they used to do, the really short segments that were funny with Carol and with Harvey Korman and Vicki Lawrence and Tim Conway and Lyle Wagner. I mean, those were my favorite. Those were the hysterical. Yeah. Yeah. But you know, Carol Burnett is 85 now, but she's still with us, bless her soul. Mm-hmm. And this was really brilliant of her, you know, to make these available to seniors across the country,
right.
All these little segments. So there are senior theater groups springing up around. And so it's really marvelous that Maury Enders at the Playhouse was able to welcome us, and that's our home now, and doing all this. But you know, do you remember, did you see the Carol Burnett show?
I have seen some of the Carol Burnett show. Some.
She did 278 episodes, and the show ran from 1967 to 1978, so 11 years. And then she came back in 1991 and did 9 more shows. But so she's been out there, but you know, she's a classic.
And what was the ear thing?
She won 35 Emmy Awards.
That's right. Well,
remember at the end of the show, she would always tug her right ear.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know why?
Yes, she was doing it to say hi to her grandmother and tell her she loved her and she was okay.
Yes.
Brought her up.
Yeah, her grandmother raised her.
Close.
And so that
even though
her grandmother died, she continued to tug her right ear.
So sweet. The Carol Burnett Show. Well, it must be a lot of fun, I think, to see this on stage and to relive some of the skits. The Carol Burnett Show is the upcoming Radioactive Players production presented at the Lincoln Community Playhouse in partnership with UNL's Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. And again, shows are April 4th at 2 p.m. and then Friday and Saturday, April 5th and 6th at 7:30 p.m. And my guests this morning have been Lita Powell Drake and Kim Osmond. And as always, you can find more information about the show, how to get into the show, and all of the details on the Friday Live page at netnebraska.org/radio. Lita and Kim, it's been a pleasure and fun talking
thank
about
Carol
Burnett.
Thank if you. If this were on television, you could see me tugging my ear.
I'm pulling the cord on my headset right now.
Thanks so much.
This is NET Radio's Friday Live. When all of the men are stripped from a remote village in France as a result of a revolution, the women agree on a most tenuous decision that will spark jealousy, anger, and resentment. Joaquital Dreher has the review of a new film opening at the Ross today.
How do women cope in the time of war? In our own history, we know women went to work and managed households until war's end. In her film, The Sower, filmmaker Marie Franson marks out the day-to-day activities of women who have to fend for themselves in a remote mountain farming village. The time is 1851, the place France. A brutal coup d'etat occurs, and on orders by President Louis-Napoleon Bonaparte, all men either are arrested and or are killed. The women and children assume the responsibility of managing life as a result of this violent state of affairs. The Sower is Marie Franson's directorial debut. She has based on the novel by Violette Hergault, written in 1919 at the age of 84. Rather than using the original title, L'homme semence, translated as the man semen, Franson entitles the film from the same name of the painting by Jean-François Millet. She deftly handles every scene. Alain Duplantier's extreme long shots of the landscape invoke visions of the gleaners in the art of Jean Millet, or the sweet grass carriers in the art of South Carolina artist Jonathan Green. Bereft and traumatized, the women band together to farm, harvest crops, and tend to the children. Some women are mothers. Some have experienced intimacy. Others find themselves with no prospects for either venture. So they make a vow. If a man comes to the village, each of them will share him as their lover. There's just one thing, though. No one asks the question, what shall we do if I fall in love with him? And he with me. Jean, the man played with delicate sensuality by Alban Lenoir, arrives in the village, and he is fine looking, and he is mysterious, and he is young. The women remark, if he was the only one left, you wouldn't make a fuss, and you'd be happy to wrap your legs around him, or I think he fancies you. He's so handsome. There is an interesting twist to the story. Pauline Berlet plays Violette, the young woman who spies Jean ambling along on the hilltop, and their interaction threatens to upend the overall peace in the village. Each actress communicates character reaction to Jean's arrival with exceptional range. Feelings are revealed via side glances as she harvests in the fields. Their hearts beat, intense desire wrapped in anxiety and sexual frustration. Alain Duplantier's cinematography interposes scenic space between dialogue and action to prevent emotions running high throughout the village from overwhelming the narrative. Franson's direction allows the story to breathe in and to breathe out, but keeping in focus the simmering conflicts. Alban Lenoir interprets Jean well as a stranger among women caught up in their sexual politics. You're all mad, stark mad, he retorts. Remarkable to the story, Franson agrees with Jean and relieves the character of his anxiety in a very practical way. The Sower plays through April 4th at the Ross Media Arts Center in Lincoln. English subtitles. Also playing through April 4th at the Ross is The Competition, Claire Simon's documentary on the behind-the-scenes politics of the selection process in La Fémis, one of the most prestigious film schools in the world. For Friday Live, I am Joaquital Dreher.
I'm Genevieve Randall. Organizers of a symposium held on the UNL campus on Monday want community members to know that the topics explored and discussions held are for everyone.
The thing that we like to do as much as we can with this symposium is really make it something that works for academics, but also for the general public. This is not simply one of those events where professors talk to one another about their research. This is something that's very much intended to be a discussion with people who have an interest in this topic.
Hear my conversation with Professors Ari Cohen and Gerald Steinacher about the 2019 Sommerhausen Symposium on this week's Friday Live Extra. Download wherever you get your podcasts, ask your smart speaker to play the Friday Live Extra podcast, or listen online at netnebraska.org/radio. Next year on Friday Live, the Nebraska Chamber Players conclude their 2018-19 season with performances tonight and Sunday afternoon at the NET Studios in Lincoln. And joining me now to talk about those concerts are Becky Van de Bogart and Ed Love. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Classical fans, hopefully tuning in here before we go to classical music to hear our discussion. Becky, what is on the program for these concerts?
You know, I'm going to go ahead and let Ed talk about that because Ed plays on this one more than I do, by a lot.
I play on two-thirds of the pieces.
two-thirds.
Right.
66% of the pieces?
Oh, no, you don't play on the Glinka, I forgot.
There's a septet by Mikhail Glinka. That I guess he wrote when he was 19 years old.
Ah, true.
And it's mostly strings and oboe, bassoon, and horn.
19.
Double bass, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I don't think I was writing music at 19. I mean, I'm not even writing music now,
right.
So.
And there's a piece by more contemporary composer, Stacy Bowers. It's called Pattern Study Number 2. It's one of those things where everybody has the same sheet of paper with 20 some little measures of various lengths you can hop around and play any of those things at any time. It's
over an ostinato that keeps.
Yeah,
going.
There's a recorded bass line.
So it's like the Terry Riley in C in a way. Then
yeah. a little more formulated than NC. It's a little more structured. Well, actually, it's a lot more structured than NC because
more rules and more structure.
Yeah, actually, it's in B flat.
I mean, it's in B flat.
Well, it's F scale with two flats in it. Anyway, it's difficult for us because it's timed. The ostinato starts and 15 minutes later it stops, and so we have to have our stopwatches on and it's time that we're supposed to get loud and everybody plays about 10 minutes in and then we're supposed to gradually fade out. Well, it's hard to wait. It's hard just to sit there and not play.
Very difficult.
I imagine it's a different experience looking at a stopwatch or having to use a stopwatch when you play. That's not necessarily the most common experience when you're playing music.
Well, right. And it's easy. You know, if somebody gives you 84 measures to count before you come in, which as a piccolo player I'm really used to.
Right.
It's very easy to sit and count 84 measures, and you just don't panic, you don't worry about anything, and then you come in and play.
Yeah.
But when you have to think about which one you're going to play and that you don't want to do it too loud and you don't want to do it too often and you don't want to come in too many times and you want to repeat or mimic or respond to something that one of the other players is doing, but not do it too much and not do it too fast and not do it too loud and not do it too early. It's an amazing amount of self-control.
So every performance and every rehearsal of the piece has been different, and I think it'll be amusing for the audience. I think it'll be fun. And then the end of the concert is the sextet by Ernst von Dohnányi, which is for clarinet, horn, violin, viola, cello, and piano.
So let's talk extremes.
Huge
with some
piano
of this
part.
Repertoire. I love extremes. What's the most fun that you'll be having playing this music this weekend?
Well, Becky only plays on one piece, so she only gets to have one.
You
little
only
bit
get
of
one choice for fun.
Mine is all about self-control, which is just not necessarily the best possible thing for me, as we all know. So I only play the Bowers.
Yeah, the last piece is a symphony. It's like 30 minutes long, and it's a brilliant piece of music. It's fascinating. It's lots of fun, and it's just been blaring very loudly in my brain for weeks now.
It's one of those things that sticks, becomes an earworm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's incredible tour de force for Jack Rinke. Incredible.
Yeah, it's pianist. Your pianist. Huge, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And for all of us.
Sorry,
I mean, my part is so much fun to play. And the last movement just rocks. It's fascinating.
Nobody sense really lays out very much, which is pretty interesting.
Talk into the microphone.
It's giving Becky mic pointers.
Nobody, nobody lays out very much, and you'd think that would make just incredibly dense texture all the way through, but he actually did a very good job of writing for everybody. So, you know, there's lots of long sustained notes that just provide carpeting, but then the solos go around it. So, it's a beautiful piece of music, but it's big.
And it's fairly modern. It's, 1930-something?
What's the most challenging? Sounds like maybe the Bowers, with having to use the
different type of challenging. It's not technically difficult; it's mentally taxing.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Right.
For sure.
As is the Dolfiani. I mean, because it's so big.
After this set of concerts this weekend, usually in the summer, there are a couple of concerts on the creek. Can we look forward to those for NCP?
Yes. In the past, we've done two in Cambridge. Last year, we went back to one just because of construction problems. And this year, instead, we're going to do one in Cambridge August 10th, and then we're going to be at the Sun Theater in Gothenburg the next day, August 11th.
Ah, fun.
And that'll be at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So the concert in Cambridge will start at 5:30, but it'll be the dinner, and then the concert at 6:30, and the Sun Theater event will be just a 2 o'clock concert.
Now, how did you get connected with the Sun Theater in Gothenburg?
Actually, I think it was Susie Larson Rodenberg that has been working with the Sun Theater, and they were looking to expand their offerings. And Susie said, call these guys. They're out in this neck of the woods every once in a while. So she did.
Well, fun fact, I'm familially connected, if that's a word, to a couple folks who have volunteered at that theater. So that was really fun to hear.
Oh, nice.
I've been in there. I've watched shows there. So.
And those concerts will be all about me, because we're doing the Beethoven and Brahms trios for clarinet.
Well, that's not true. I get to play.
Oh, that's right. You get to play a song.
One piece again.
Oh, you too. I tell you what. Well, there's much to look forward to with Nebraska Chamber Players. They are concluding their 2018-19 season with performances tonight at 8 p.m. 8 p.m., is that correct?
That is correct.
Come early for the wine and food, and then stay for the music.
There you go. And then Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m., both of those are held in the Ron Hull Studio at NET in Lincoln. Becky van de Bogart and Ed Love, thanks for telling us about the concert.
Thanks, Genevieve. Have a great day.
I'm Genevieve Randall. The TBD Dance Collective performs a couple of times at Kaneko in Omaha this weekend. KVNO's Corbin Hirschhorn tells us what they'll be performing.
This weekend, TBD Dance Collective returns to Kaneko for the next installment of the movement series, Mode of Being. Now officially a nonprofit, the Modern Dance Troupe's productions have expanded along with their role in the community. Co-directors of TBD, Kat Fackler and Stephanie Hittner.
Something that's exciting about it, I feel, is it's an enormous collaboration this time.
It's enormous. There are many, many people involved. There's six musicians involved, a giant 5x5 modular platform that we deconstruct. I think this show is probably our biggest undertaking with productions thus far, I would say.
Right. I agree. Yeah. And what's kind of funny is Kat and I went into it wanting it to be just a really simple, kind of torn down process, just really bare bones, more about maybe the dance and focus on that, not really worry about other things, and it's kind of exploded.
In addition to featuring an original score and a custom stage, Mode of Being will take place in two of Kaneko's galleries, upstairs and on the main floor.
We want to take advantage, since the whole goal of this is to bring people into the galleries and to see the artwork and kind of see it in a different way. By moving throughout the space, you can see more of it, obviously, you know, so that makes sense. So we can be inspired by work in one gallery and then leave that space to go to a whole new world, like Kat was saying before, so you can experience several things within the same evening.
Yeah. I think it's also, the traveling for me is cool because I think it kind of shifts and redefines this idea of performance and redefines this idea of what the stage is. And there technically is no stage, I think, when you move the audience like that, and you kind of remove that barrier between the audience and the performers.
Divided between multiple sections of the gallery, the performance also changes thematically throughout the night. The choreography physically interprets a range of human emotions while also being inspired by everyday activities.
We kind of played around with this really fun idea of task-based movement. Mm-hmm. So we gave each dancer kind of this generic, mundane task that happens throughout the day. So whether it's folding your clothes or waking up, stretching, getting dressed, getting undressed, these things that we do every day that you don't really think about, you just do them. They're just a part of your habits and your rituals and your patterns that make up your day. And then each dancer sort of created this phrase based off of that task and created a loop for themselves to get stuck in.
TBD Dance Collective's Mode of Being, part of the Movement series, is this weekend at Kaneko with two performances tonight at 7 p.m. and 9 p.m. and Saturday at 7 p.m. For more information or tickets, visit thekaneko.org. For Friday Live, I'm Corbin Hirschhorn.
Coming up this morning on NET Radio, classical music on Morning Concert, and this afternoon, Laura Black and Classics by Request. Be sure to visit the NET website for podcasts of the show at netnebraska.org/radio. Thanks to everyone who makes Friday Live possible, including Elise Stastny, engineer James DeShano, and associate producer and birthday boy, Dave Hughes. I'm Genevieve Randall.